Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Do you follow the health news? Do you find it frustrating sometimes how one week you'll hear something's good for you, and then weeks later, you'll hear just the opposite? It can be maddening the way research findings are covered in the media. Even more deeply alarming than the week-to-week variability of various observational studies, the kind that tell us certain foods, for example, are good or bad for us, are what we in the medical field call medical reversals. Such reversals occur when accepted medical dogma is overturned, and to hear my guest today talk about it, this happens with alarming frequency. Here's an example. For years, doctors prescribed a certain class of antiarrhythmic agents. This is a type of heart pill to suppress slightly abnormal heartbeats known as premature ventricular contractions, or what we might commonly call a skip beat. The idea was that in people who have heart disease, PVCs as they're known, would lead to more dangerous heart rhythms. So the logic was to suppress them and thereby prevent the spiral toward cardiac death. Until finally there was a more rigorous research trial done which showed that not only did the antiarrhythmic agents not prevent heart attacks or fatal arrhythmias, they actually caused more of them. The study that proved this caused a major shift in medical practice. But this is only the tip of an iceberg, according to my guest today. Dr. Adam Cifu, co-author of the book Ending Medical Reversal, which posits that the medical profession adopts ineffective or harmful practices only to abandon them, sometimes too late. The book is just out in paperback from Johns Hopkins Press. It's not a technical book, but if you're interested in the clinical science aspect of why doctors do what we do, it's an excellent read. Adam Cifu is a professor of medicine at the University of Chicago, where for 2 decades he's been in charge of teaching medical students about internal medicine. He recently was named Associate Dean for Medical School Academics at the University of Chicago's Pritzker School of Medicine. Adam Cifu, co-author of Ending Medical Reversal, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa, Medical Monday. Dr. Adam Cifu, welcome to Medical Monday. Let's start by having you just define what a medical reversal is.
Sure. Medical reversal is, I guess I should sort of step back and say, you know, most of the time when medical practice changes, the way we like it to change is that we run a clinical trial of a new drug, a new procedure, and we find out that it's better than something that went before, and therefore we adopt this as a new form of therapy for people, and that's sort of how medicine progresses. Medical reversal is not the way we like things to go, and it's when medicine adopts a treatment or a diagnostic test or a surgical therapy based on inadequate data, and maybe it's a bad study, or maybe it's just because this medication or this procedure seems to make sense. And then after that therapy is sort of out there in the world, having been deployed with doctors prescribing it and patients using it, we then get good data, usually through a randomized clinical trial, and we learn that, oops, we made a mistake, you know, that this therapy is ineffective or works no better than some simple, you know, inexpensive, painless procedure or therapy that went before, and we have to kind of backtrack and drop a newly adopted therapy and go back to a previous therapy.
So late in the book, you and your co-author, Dr. Vinay Prasad, try to figure out how often this phenomenon actually occurs. And I guess reading the book, I would have thought, oh, it's probably not something that happens all that often. I mean, and you definitely highlight some pretty well-known cases and then some pretty maybe more obscure cases for, you know, lay audiences or regular people.
Yeah.
But it happens a surprising amount. And can you just elaborate on that? Like, tell us how much you think medical reversal actually occurs and I guess how you figured that out.
Yeah, I agree. It happens much more than I think anybody thinks. You know, Vinay and I started this project just because we had both experienced, either in the clinic or in the hospital, that kind of uncomfortable situations where we'd recommended a medication or a procedure and then had to go back to the patient 6 months or a year later and say, hey, you know that medication I recommended? Well, you know, we've learned that it doesn't actually work and we should do something else. And so we thought, boy, is this just something that's very memorable when it happens, or is it something which happens frequently? And we realize it's a very difficult question to answer. To get a real answer, you'd have to sort of study everything that doctors recommend, go to the literature, see what has a good evidence base, and therapies that don't have a good evidence base, you'd have to do the trials to figure it out. And that would take, you know, multiple careers to complete. So we looked at this in multiple ways, and the one which I think has been the most fruitful is we've done two or three studies where we've looked at the major journals that doctors use, and we look at the trials that those journals publish, and we've tried to look at to categorize those into trials that look at new drugs or procedures or therapies, or trials that look at therapies which are already deployed and out there being used. And of that set, to then say, well, you know, what percentage of those studies show that what we're doing is correct, and what percentage of those studies show that what we're doing is incorrect? And it turns out that anywhere, depending on what journal you looked at and what year you're looking at, anywhere between 10 to 40% of the articles that are published in the major medical journals that are studying already adopted therapies show that those already adopted therapies are ineffective.
I mean, that's just shocking. I mean, first of all, you put a range on it, 10 to 40%. But when you look specifically at, you know, perhaps the most august journal, the New England Journal of Medicine, it was 40%, and that was in a one-year period. So you put a few caveats in there, such as, you know, the New England Journal likes to be provocative or publish, you know, studies with sort of the biggest findings. So you're willing to qualify that down. But when you look at it and you have a number like 40%, as you point out, that's almost half of the things that we I mean, it's just shocking.
Right.
So, all right. So we've talked about medical reversal here, what it is, but it's maybe still subtle. So let's start with an example. And you point out that doctors, we do a whole number of things that make some kind of logical sense, some kind of maybe anatomical, physical sense. And then when we actually study them in randomized trials, they turn out to not only, in most cases, not be effective, but detrimental. So do you have a favorite case of medical reversal that comes to mind?
Well, I often, when I talk about this, I often start with the thing that stimulated me to begin this research, and that was estrogen replacement therapy. And it's an old example, but it's a really good example for a whole bunch of reasons. So estrogen replacement therapy, and I'm talking about prophylactic estrogen replacement therapy. So this is just that any woman, when she gets into her, you know, early 50s, let's say, and is passing through menopause, gets prescribed estrogen replacement therapy to substitute for the natural estrogen that she has produced for her life up until that point. And we adopted this therapy because, one, it made a lot of sense. We knew that women developed less heart disease when they, before menopause, and started developing more heart disease after menopause. And so it made sense that, well, what changes is the estrogen level. So maybe if we continue higher estrogen levels, that will prevent heart disease. And then we had some observational data that said that if we look at women who take estrogen and compare them to women who don't take estrogen, the women who took estrogen actually do better. And so we made the jump and said, well, if that's true, let's just start prescribing estrogen. And this was common practice when I kind of went out on my own and, you know, became an attending physician. And then a few years later, we started to get the first big randomized trial data that said, well, you know, when we actually take women who are exactly the same, who are randomized to estrogen replacement therapy or a matched placebo, there's no real benefit to estrogen replacement therapy. And in fact, there's some harm to estrogen replacement therapy. And we had to walk back that whole practice pattern of giving prophylactic estrogen replacement therapy. I should add, estrogen replacement therapy still has some role. Short-term estrogen replacement therapy is very effective for perimenopausal symptoms, but it's not something that we just prescribe to everybody as they pass through menopause as sort of a normal part of medical therapy.
Right. So the risks on a population-based level, prescribing it to everybody, are too great for, say, a promotion of breast cancer or blood clots, things like that. But it is very useful for vasomotor symptoms, i.e. hot flashes. So we still use it. Okay. So that's a great example. I want to point out what you also taught me in the book, which is, you know, the reason that medical reversal is so frustrating is, for one thing, it seems like we are putting out what turns out to be wrong information. But there's a sort of a worse effect, is that you point out that these types of practices that are in the, you know, medical world for so long are like a freight train. They're hard to slow down. And so that we can use that estrogen replacement therapy as an example. And then there's another reason, which is it causes people a lot of mistrust of their doctors and healthcare in general.
That is true. You know, when I think about the harms of medical reversal, I first think about the costs, and the costs are actually real monetary costs, right? There's no less cost-effective therapy than a therapy which is not helping people at all. You're basically paying for costs without benefits. There's sort of an opportunity cost, right? In some of our examples, people are getting therapies which are ineffective when there are more effective therapies out there, and they're missing out on therapies which would be better for them. Sometimes, you know, I think less commonly, but some of the therapies that we looked at actually have at least a small incidence of real harm. So you're doing something which has no benefit and actually hurts people. But then a whole other set, as you mentioned, is that, you know, when patients or just people who aren't patients yet, hear on the radio, read in the newspaper about a therapy that they've had or a friend had or you know, a loved one has had, which then is overturned and is no longer used, they really begin to question, you know, do these doctors know what they're doing? Should I trust what I'm being told? And I have some patients who, when I, you know, offer up a recommendation, which I think is well thought out, they'll hearken back to some medication I stopped that I had started, and they'll say, you know, is this going to be like estrogen replacement therapy, or is this going to be like Atenolol for my blood pressure? That you had me on, and then you told me that we needed to take me off it because you learned that it was ineffective. Those are hard conversations to have.
Ouch, yeah. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Dr. Adam Seafew. He's a professor of medicine at the University of Chicago and their Pritzker School of Medicine. He's also the co-author of an incredible book called Ending Medical Reversal, a subtitle, Improving Outcomes, Saving Lives. He co-wrote that with Dr. Vinay Prasad of Oregon Health Sciences University. And Adam, let's talk about some other examples. So some of these get even more difficult, but I'll start with ones that may be less difficult. So for example, there's this idea known as vertebroplasty. This is something you write about where, okay, so if older folks sometimes have thinning bone and they get a bone fracture in their spine, which sounds horrible and is horrible and is incredibly painful, you know, a logical thing might be, hey, if we inject some bone cement in there to solidify it, you know, what could possibly be the harm? Well, you tell us.
Right. Vertebroplasty is a terrific example, and it's actually still one that is actually still controversial. And you describe it terrifically. It's one of those procedures that absolutely should work. People get compression fractures where the vertebrae, which almost everybody can picture what they look like, just collapse under the weight of the world for decades and decades, right? And that can be incredibly painful, and it's a fairly common occurrence, especially in older women with osteoporosis. And the idea was that, well, you know, if we inject medical cement in there and sort of puff up that bone, stabilize things, give the nerves a little bit more room, people should feel better. And based on essentially that mechanistic argument and some not very well done observational studies, that was adopted, became very, very common, enormous amounts of money spent on this procedure, mostly through Medicare, since it's mostly for older patients. And then there were two really beautiful, though quite small, randomized trials done in the New England Journal of Medicine. I think both studies had about 120, 130 patients. And what it said is that if you randomize people to either vertebroplasty or a sham procedure where people were taken to the operating room, you know, they were numbed up, the cement was open so the patient could actually smell it, and then just saline was injected into their spine rather than the cement, that the patients did just as well. And it turned out that looking at that data, it looked like vertebroplasty was essentially a placebo intervention. We're going to do something to your back, which is going to seem very special, and we're going to tell you it's going to help, and lo and behold, it does help people.
I'm not as familiar with vertebroplasty. Is it something that's largely been discarded, or is it it's still done quite a bit, isn't it?
It is still done quite a bit. So what's happened is that it's done in somewhat different ways, often these days called kyphoplasty rather than vertebroplasty. And the studies that have been done have shown that it doesn't work in one group of patients, but has, you know, we have not shown that it doesn't work in every group of patients. And so many physicians therefore say, well, you know, we don't have data that it doesn't work in this group of patients, and it makes sense, so let's do it. That's really, to my mind, the wrong approach. We should not do things to or for patients without data just because we have no evidence that it's ineffective. I think when we adopt a therapy in medicine, it really falls to us to have certain proof that this is going to benefit at least, you know, the vast majority of patients who receive the therapy. Saying that, well, you haven't shown me that it doesn't work, is not a reason to use a therapy.
Well, because you could go wild with that argument, that
right.
Negative argument, like, oh, well, we've never shown it to be ineffective, therefore let's do everything.
Exactly.
And
certainly there are times that we have to use therapies which haven't been well proven, right? There are emergencies. There are times that there is no proven therapy. And at that time, it falls to the doctor to sit with a patient and say, listen, this is where we are in your care. This is what I have to offer. This is the proof that it works or doesn't work. And sometimes, certainly, patients will choose to try not well-proven things because, you know, maybe that's all there is, and it's worth a try.
Let's give one more orthopedic example, because I like those, because of this idea of sham surgery. And I think for listeners who haven't heard about that, this whole idea of a randomized trial involving surgery where all of the effects, if you will, of the surgery minus the actual surgery part being done is quite a powerful placebo. But there's an arthroscopic knee surgery for, is it cartilage or osteoarthritis? I forget which one you wrote about, but where this was finally studied, where we'd been doing this for years trying to help people with knee pain. And what did we find out?
Sure. This has been a big one. So the menisci are little cartilage pillows, basically, in your knee, which allows your knee to function. You know, we've probably all heard about athletes who tear their meniscus and need to have them fixed. But it turns out that sometimes the menisci get torn not because of an injury, but just because of degeneration, that as we get older and we get arthritis in our knees, that sometimes those little cartilage pillows kind of rip as they break down. And for a long time, when people would present with knee pain and a degenerative meniscal tear, as we call it, orthopedics would go in there and fix it and say, okay, you know, something's torn, we should make it better. And it started with a very small study at one institution and has broadened out from there, where patients were randomized to either the sort of what was the standard of care, really, fixing these degenerative meniscal tears, or doing a sham surgery, where, again, an arthroscope was inserted, but instead of doing a surgery there, there was just kind of a look, or maybe just an incision made. So the patient came out of there saying, oh, you know, they must have worked on my knee. And again, shows us that the procedure that had been being done was really ineffective, or at least no more effective than a sham intervention.
Wow. I mean, it's just, it turns everything kind of upside down. It really does.
It does. It does. And especially in settings like that where, and this is often the case, that the therapy that has been adopted makes a whole lot of sense. You know, you say, look, this is broken. If we fix it, it's got to be better. But the fact is, you know, the human body's pretty amazing. A lot of things just get better on their own, and we really have to test and be convinced. And when we get in there and change things, whether it be surgically or medically, that makes a difference.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Adam Cifu. He is professor of medicine at the University of Chicago and co-author of the book Ending Medical Reversal, which is just out in paperback from Johns Hopkins Press. And it is really a tour de force in understanding medical evidence and kind of why doctors do what we do. Probably aimed at a sort of a medical audience, but really great for lay readers if you're interested in the science and you're sort of an armchair doctor person looking up everything on Google. This is a book you will really like if you want to understand the way that doctors think. And Adam, I was picking on orthopedics there, but let's pick on our own field of medicine or primary care and talk for a second about surrogate outcomes. These are, I'll let you tell us, what are surrogate outcomes and what's the danger in relying on those in terms of trying to manage illness?
So the line that that Vinay Prasad and I came up with is that a surrogate outcome is an outcome that you didn't know was important until your doctor told you it was important. So let's talk about diabetes, for instance. So when you go to the doctor with diabetes, the things that you care about, or certainly even before you go to the doctor, once you've been told a little bit about diabetes by the doctor, is if you care about having your diabetes treated so you do well over time, right? And that means that you don't suffer the complications that diabetes risks. You don't have a heart attack, you don't have a stroke, you don't develop painful neuropathy or kidney failure, and those things are important. And certainly that you don't have symptoms from your sugars being too high. You know, you're not fatigued, you're not urinating all the time from high sugars. So those are clinical outcomes, and those are the things that matter to patients and really should matter to doctors. Surrogate outcomes are kind of stand-ins for those. And so in diabetes, it would be a hemoglobin A1C, which is a blood test which shows us what kind of control a person's diabetes is under. And there are surrogate endpoints for just about everything we take care of in medicine, right? So if we think about osteoporosis, we treat osteoporosis to prevent fractures, but a surrogate endpoint on that might be a bone density, which is an X-ray result. And we use surrogate endpoints because they're very easy to study. You don't have to wait as long to see a change in someone's bone density as you do in waiting to see if they have a fracture or not. But where surrogate endpoints sometimes throw us off is some of our treatments we've learned do a good job at improving surrogate endpoints, but don't actually improve the clinical endpoints that patients and doctors really should be interested in.
Yeah, so let's take the example of, I guess, cholesterol. Why not? Because
right.
I don't think there's any better example in maybe the history of American medicine. I mean, everyone in America, it seems like, knows that, you know, cholesterol is bad for us and our cholesterol is too high and that does increase our risk of heart attacks or strokes or things like that.
Yeah.
But the cholesterol really is a number. It's not in and of itself a disease or something we feel.
Right.
So take us through some of the thinking on how our treatment of cholesterol has changed.
Right. And why cholesterol is such a wonderful example is that you are right. We know that if we look at a population of patients, that patients with higher cholesterol do worse than people with lower cholesterol. And when I say do worse, it means they are more likely to have cardiovascular events, heart attacks, strokes, angina over time. Okay. But what's interesting is that when we get in there and lower cholesterol, that doesn't necessarily mean that that group of patients in whom we've lowered their cholesterol is going to do better. Now, it turns out that when we use the most popular cholesterol-lowering medication these days, and one of the most popular classes of medications, you know, in America, the statin medication, things like atorvastatin, Lipitor, simvastatin, Zocor, those medications both lower cholesterol and decrease the clinical endpoints. But it's not all the medications. So an older medication like niacin or cholestyramine, which actually works to lower cholesterol and therefore improve the surrogate outcome, does not change the clinical outcome. So you might have better cholesterol, but you'll be at the exact same risk of having a heart attack or a stroke as you were without the medication.
Well put. Adam, I want to shift gears here for a second. You are a prolific writer, and you've written a series of essays. In fact, you're sort of a regular columnist in the Journal of the American Medical Association. You do something called JAMA Clinical Guidelines Synopses. You take recommendations from various medical authorities and you put them through scrutiny to decide how strong the evidence base is on those. And those are, I think, extremely useful to doctors and trainees, residents, and students. I think those are really useful. But I want to focus here on one of the essays. This is actually just out in one of the JAMA specialty journals, JAMA Neurology. But the title of the essay, and it's very short, is Why Do You Want to Be a Physician? And Adam, you've been a medical educator for more than 2 decades. You've interviewed people for medical school. You have led an internal medicine clerkship for, I think, almost 20 years, if not more. So you wind up interviewing a lot of people and writing a lot of letters of recommendation. Take us through this question, why do you want to be a physician? It's something that I think every doctor, every medical student gets asked. And you were a little bit skeptical about this question, both when you had to answer it and then when you had to ask it. You were ready to throw the question out, but then your thinking kind of changed.
It's true. I went through years, and Sean, I'm sure you probably answered this question in exactly the way I answered it, when I was first applying to medical school. The question drove me crazy, both as an applicant and then as an interviewer, because what almost everybody says is some variation on, I want to be a doctor because I want to help people. And also because, you know, I love science. I love the intellectual challenge of science. I'm good at science. And this allows me to combine, you know, my love of science and my talent in science with my sort of generous part of my personality that makes me want to help people. And, you know, when you've asked that question dozens of times and gotten the same answer in various ways, you're like, God, why am I asking this question? What am I getting out of this? And it was funny. It was just last year I had a college student actually with me in my clinic who was working at the University of Chicago and was set up with me to just sort of get a flavor for what clinical medicine was. And she asked me, and I launched into this story, which, and I won't go through in detail in the article, but about an experience with my grandmother, who was a nurse when I was a kid and I was at the doctor. And we were sitting in the waiting room and she was sort of pointing out all the patients and what they were there for. And it was magic to me hearing her make these diagnoses and say these words. And I reflected after the fact, you know, it's interesting. Why did I tell this woman this story? I've never told this story before about why I wanted to be a doctor. And what struck me is that, you know, although we often get the same answer from everybody to that question, there's often a lot of nuance in how people answer the question. And that often we can learn a lot about the person, about their experiences with the medical field, about who's helped them, as they approach medicine, about their expectations for the future and their expectations for their career, that I was, I think, often ignoring when I got the usual, I'm good at science and I want to help people sort of answer.
I loved the essay. I thought it was quite something. The name of the book is Ending Medical Reversal, and it is co-authored by my guest today, Dr. Adam Seafew from the University of Chicago. Adam, thank you so much for joining us.
John, thanks so much for having me. It's really a pleasure talking to you.
Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening.